have experienced it before, moving between cultures, the one you know and the one you choose. Now, for immigrants, the switch is clear, but we all do it. And it's in that special place in between that you find out who you really are. Amitava Kumar's latest novel, Immigrant Montana, takes you to that special place. It's about an immigrant who leaves his home in eastern India and enrolls in graduate school here in the USA during the 1990s. Immigrant Montana is published by Alfred A. Knopp. Amitava Kumar, welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
If we look at the title of this book, because obviously the official title is Immigrant Montana, a novel. But on the cover, I see a couple of words crossed off. I see lover, Bihar, and a meditation. What's that about? Is there a secret story going on here?
Yes, I think my editor thought that Immigrant Montana would be a puzzle or wouldn't be clear to people. So he wanted to bring out the subtext, the lover. Not Montana, but my place of origin, Bihar in India. And perhaps he wanted to remark on the fact that this is equal parts novel and an essay, and so he called it meditation. I think that's what, I mean, I'm guessing. I didn't inquire too much.
You're guessing, but you're the author. So do we have an essay and we have a novel? Do both narratives exist in the same plane?
They do. I didn't think that the traditional novel, was a very convincing model to write at the present moment. I mean, Duarte, you and I, when we have a moment, we check out Twitter, we are on Facebook, the news comes to us in little bits. So how to present that? In other words, how to present not just a story that is going on in a linear way, but also have all these kinds of interruptions, images, news, little clippings that I have put in my notebook, all of that. So that's the novel existing in some sort of a creative tension with the essay, if you'll allow.
That's fascinating, and it's sort of ingenious, the novel existing with an essay. Now, one member of my team described it as one of the best books she's read in years.
Yes!
But how do you describe it?
I described it at the end of the novel as an in-between novel by an in-between man.
In-between novel by an in-between man. You incorporate a lot of quotes in that. That's why.
Yes. Because, you know, I think our life is made up of quotes, you know. When my son speaks to me, he's sometimes, you know, intoning Kanye, sometimes it's Liliati. And in my case, it's a little bit, somewhat more stuffier, boring people, you know, who have written books.
Well, I don't know how stuffy you are. Now, the main character story is told in chapters that's designated by the names of women that he's been involved with in each chapter. Why are these women so central to his story?
Good point. Yeah, that's, I think, where the lover part comes in. How do you tell the story of identity through a search for love? I was trying to remember that time in my youth when you defined yourself a little bit by the person you were in love with. And so I had my character here think a little bit about different women. And some of them are fictional, you know, some with different histories, extraordinary histories, whom he meets. And how, so that's what's going on. Why, love being the way to identity, and love, which is something we don't, you know, I've said somewhere in the beginning of the book that when someone looks at the darker, immigrants standing in their line at JFK, do they think, oh, here's a person who is looking for love? They don't. They think, here's a person who will come and take my job. I mean, if they're feeling ungenerous. If they're feeling more generous, perhaps they think, hey, I'll help this person out. But they don't associate that person with a desire for love. But that's where I've put it here. Like, here's a person who has come here and he's going to seek his identity, mostly by falling in love.
And he falls in love quite a bit. Now, there are two main characters here, one who lives in the 1990s and one who is looking back in time.
Yeah. That's the older, you know, person, narrator, looking back at himself. And there I was closer to another person who in the book serves as a model. Here was a man, he's based on a real character here called Iqbal Ahmed, who, you know, grew up in a village close to mine in India, but migrated to Pakistan, then to Princeton, then to Tunisia. He was jailed, in the 70s here for conspiring to kidnap Kissinger because he was protesting the Vietnam War with the Catholic brothers. So that older figure for me, and also the older figure in the book here, are close together. They are more meditative, they are calmer, and they can look back with a certain degree of wisdom rather than simply passion or stupidity.
You speak about wisdom, passion, and stupidity, and you're right about it as well. I mean, there were scenes in the book. I remember the main character talking about sex with his friends in India before he comes to the U.S. And then he speaks about, and then he finally has sex. And there's this whole controversy because his friends want him to send them a postcard that essentially says, yes, I've made it to the promised land.
Yes.
And I've had sex. But that scene is about so much more than that.
Yeah.
What did it represent for you? Because he doesn't send the postcard.
I should confess that when I was coming here, I was told by one man, one boy, actually, he was a young man. He said, will you send me a postcard once you've slept with someone? How shall we say? Both of us had were burdened with our untested sexuality. And so I did think about it later on.
Did you send the postcard?
Actually, I should also further confess that I sent it long before any such good acts happened to me. I just sent it as a joke, you know? So
What did you say in such a postcard?
I just...
Because everyone could read it along the way. What did you say?
You're shaming me, but Duarte, but my friend had said I should have written, I have eaten cherry.
Wow.
So that's what I wrote, and that was all. You have extracted a confession out of a poor man here.
No, I mean, a genius man. I mean, is this book autobiographical
in some way? It's in some ways, of course. It's an in-between book. It's between autobiography and utter invention. And I think one of the exciting things is precisely that invention, you know?
So you would say, what, 20, 30% is based on your experiences?
Mathematics was never my strong point. I don't know.
So, you know, you wrote an article for The Baffler called Material Witness, The Novelist and the Liar.
Yes.
Is this book a work of the novelist or the liar? Because obviously there is some truth, but yes, it's also fictional.
Yes. I think every novelist is a liar. But not lie in any moral bad sense. You're lying in the sense that you're presenting truth as a fabrication. There's, you know, even an artifice, which you think of as false, even in artifice, there is art. And that is what the novelist does. Yes, but I should tell you, the Knopf lawyer had me come in and we had a conversation about this. And she had a question, is this all true? And in the Baffler piece, I had originally wanted to say, I answered the questions as truthfully as I could. And when necessary, I lied. and that was partly a joke, you know, it was a joke. It's a performance. But that, I think, is what the novelist does.
Did she clear you? Were you cleared by the lawyers?
Yes, I was, yes.
You know, it's sort of fascinating. So am I to believe that there are seeds, like real people are the seeds for all your characters?
No, not all of them, no. And I can't tell you which one because all my life, my great aesthetic striving has been to put down on paper things that will then, when read, appear to the reader as being true, that this actually occurred. So if that is the impression I'm giving to people, I think I'm doing all right.
And that's how you make good art?
I think so. You know, so that you look out up from the page and look out of the window, and what you see is not different from what is happening on the page, but a part of it.
Is that the role of honesty within fiction?
Honesty is a great point. I think honesty, the idea of a more honest sense of oneself, to be able to see more clearly who one is should be a great goal. I've always said to my students, don't try to be righteous. Just try to be real. Be honest. Don't try to, in other words, sound ideal. Don't try to sound noble. Try to sound true. Accept your follies and present them on the page.
And that's what you've done really expertly.
Thank you, sir.
Your main character, he's always addressing a judge in the book, trying to make a case to someone, and this judge happens to be white. Why is the judge white, and what's going on there?
Because who do you address in authority here, you know? I would address a black person in solidarity. But the person in authority who can deport you, in my mind, is always white. And it doesn't have to be a real white person, and not all white people are, of course, being condemned in this way or anything. But that's how it is. So also the idea of being an imposter or being unwanted, this idea was always there in my mind. And so I have the narrator. It's as if he has been stopped on the highway for speeding, in a way. Speeding on the highway to authenticity or a true identity. And he's always having to justify what he was doing. Look, you know, officer, I was going to pick up my child, or I'm sorry that I went. I was only 5 miles above the speed limit. That sort of a thing.
But why does he need to justify his inner feelings to that judge? I have feelings. I'm sure you have feelings. Sure. No one ever knows. You don't have to justify them. Yeah. But your character does. Why?
That's a good question. I just thought that especially if I presented that dialogue in italics, it would be different from what he does with other people. It's as if he is guilty of something. And guilt, I think your question has driven me to make this statement. I hope it doesn't damn me. I think guilt should always be a part of desire too. So that you're having to say to someone why you wanted someone or you wanted something. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Was that your experience as a young immigrant?
That has been my experience all my life, man. But, you know, I'm from the land of the Buddha, where the Gautam Buddha said, you know, desire is the seat of misery, you know. You have to give up desire to find peace. So this idea that there is something to be absolved if you're full of desire, I think that is what I'm always thinking about. What about you as a young man? Have you been free of all guilt?
Oh, no, I have guilt right now.
Yeah. Cool. Yes.
Is the guilt of leaving his past behind significant?
Yes.
Why? How so?
Well, you know, my 85-year-old father is visiting me right now. I'm guilty of the fact right now, conscious at this moment that I abandoned my parents in India, you know? So that is a part of guilt. Coming here, there are all kinds of guilt. I mean, I feel, for example, sometimes that even as a writer, I have failed myself in not being in India, where the stories are teeming around me and that stories need to be told. It has been great to be here. I have benefited from my education. It has been a hell of a ride teaching students, you know, who some of them are great. But there are all sorts of guilt, yes. And that is part of this book, yes.
Does he give up his desire?
I think he finds a greater peace towards the end of the book. But he recalls. See, the older guy is remembering, is writing all this down because he says he's thinking that the body forgets. The body forgets even what is most intimate to it. And so he wants to put it down on paper. What it meant to be in love, or what it meant to be afire with desire. You know, that sort of thing.
Does that internal judge go away finally, or is he always there? That white man, white man in his mind.
Yeah. No, he has remained in conversation, but perhaps their relationship has changed. They are less unequal. He's speaking back in a more measured tones.
Now, this is not like a normal coming-of-age book about immigrants. This is different. This is much more nuanced about that special place that is neither there nor here.
That's right.
Do you still feel that you're in that place, or are you firmly right here?
Nah, one never leaves. I think the in-between place is partly out of my own desire also, a good place to be. I mean, it's a good place to do the dance so that you're not... Your feet doesn't remain stuck in the concrete of one sort of belonging, you know? So that you're smooth like you.
I wish. There was one scene
where
he ends up getting someone pregnant, an older woman.
Yes.
And she goes to end the pregnancy, and he's with her, and he doesn't say anything.
Yes.
And that is a moment of profound regret for him. Why?
Because it's a very sad moment. And I felt the pathos of that scene grow. And I was very happy when my editor then made me go back and add things to it. And, you know, talking about fiction, And then I remembered when my wife was pregnant, a certain moment of sadness and her breaking down somewhere. And then I tried to build that scene more powerfully from there because I was so much in touch also with my wife's sadness at that moment. So it's just like that whole scene is a bit about things going always wrong, things going wrong between people, especially a woman, you know, in that scene.
There was a line that you wrote that still haunts me, where he says about this, anything I had said, like when he talks about what he was feeling bad about.
Yeah.
And it was anything I had said, but instead everything I left unsaid was what he felt worst about.
Yes.
And that resonates with so many of us.
Yes.
Did it happen to you? Do you resonate with the things that you didn't say or didn't write?
Yeah. Yeah. I think some of the things we just say and feel bad about is only the surface of things. Think of all the things you did not say to all the people in your life. The moment where, for example, you could have turned back and kissed your mother. Or the moment before someone died and you never once thought of going and saying before they died how much they had meant to you. All of this. I'm always haunted by those memories.
There was one scene that made me chuckle a little bit where your main character, he sees this ad where Gandhi is portrayed.
Yes.
What was that ad? What was that?
Yeah, it was something like, I had actually seen that ad, I think near Union Square.
Well, you got to describe it. Describe it because everyone wants to know what this ad said.
It was an ad for a gym and it said, Gandhi was a great man, but he could do some work on his triceps or something like that. You know,
he didn't have the abs.
Yeah, I don't. But they mentioned. I remember the triceps. And then it said that there was an early bird special. And in my essayistic mode, I have written there that Gandhi would have appreciated the early bird special. He was a man who was very austere, and he would have liked to get that little discount. And he would have been there early, bright and early, you know, his staff in hand to take advantage. So yeah.
Your book is fantastic. Is there something that people often miss?
In books, you mean, or
in your book?
Well,
what is the most misunderstood part? And we're running out of time.
Yes. In my own case, I'll just say, in real life, I think people often do not allow immigrants to have a sense of humor. I have often had to, what I thought was a good joke, had to repeat, and still people say, like, what? And that, I think, is what people need to know about the book, too. That is funny, man, you know? It's someone voicing their fears, their follies, giving voice to all sorts of things, a performance. Don't misunderstand that part. Don't instead become all moralizing and think it is real in a different form kind of way. No, it's a performance. It's a dance.
It's all a performance and a dance, and it's one incredible dance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.